Welcome to the Art Grind Podcast. This is a podcast run by artists for artists where we talk about what it means to be one. I'm Tun Mian, the producer, with our host Dina Brodsky and Marshall Jones.
Hey, Art Grind listeners, before we get into our regular interview, we have a little bit of a call to action. You guys probably remember a year ago, Birds for Sophia show that actually saved a little girl's life. Dina is involved in starting a new project. Hopefully, if all things go well and you guys participate, we'll have a good chance at saving another girl's life. Dina, could you tell us a little bit about this project?
Okay. Honestly, the project, even to me, sounds a little bit insane. Sophia, the girl from The Last Bird Show, but she's learning how to sit up and I think actually learning how to stand with help and just meeting all of her normal baby milestones.
How old is she now?
She's a little bit over a year. So she's meeting her baby milestones a few months later than she would have if this whole thing hadn't happened to her, if she didn't have this disease. But a year ago, she couldn't lift her head. I mean, she couldn't do anything. She kept ending up in the hospital because she couldn't breathe. So for those of you guys who participated in Birds for Sophia, thank you, because it sounds like she's just going to have a normal life.
That's really great. It's amazing you put all that together. So what's the new project?
The new project involves something that neither me or Marshall actually likes, which is NFTs. But that being said, think about it this way. The last time I saw so much incredibly good bird art submitted, and you know, I think only 50 artists ended up in the show, but I probably found hundreds of artists that I liked. So this is a Birds for Sophia NFT, and it's going to involve 1,000 artists, provided an artist actually do this, right? Then all they have to do is submit an image on Instagram, hashtag a Birds for Sophia NFT. Birds for Sophia was an F, not the other spelling of Sophia, which some people have been doing, and passing instructions on to other artists. And after we get 1,000, we are going to stitch it all together into one giant NFT and try to auction it off for the price that this particular kid needs to bridge the gap, which is, oh God, it's something like $1.5 million. It's a crazy amount of money.
So you'll try to auction off the NFT in hopes to get $1 million plus for this NFT?
You know, it seems like there's a lot of money in NFTs right now. And I feel like there's all this new wealth that's been created by cryptocurrency. I feel like a lot of those people would actually want to do something good with that wealth. So part of the NFT would actually be getting to save a life, right? So you get 1,000 bird images, but you also get to save a baby. And I feel like if at least some of NFTs about bragging rights, about saying that you own something, then maybe owning the act of saving a life is actually kind of amazing, right?
This is like the first time I've ever liked the idea of an NFT, because it sounds like it's actually bringing people together and auctioning something off that's for a cause rather than just some JPEG, you know?
So it's going to be a lot of JPEGs, but a lot of them will be really, really good bird art. And if this works, honestly, guys, for all of you who are listening, I hope it'll work. I'm not really sure. It seems like a moonshot, but this particular kid she's a few pounds away from the weight at which the pharmaceutical companies that make the drug, Novartis, at which Novartis won't give her the drug anymore. So basically, if she gains a few pounds, then she stops being eligible for it. So the people that were running her fundraiser reached out to me about this. And I was just thinking that seems to be at least a shot of raising a lot of money for her very quickly. Otherwise, these fundraisers, the successful ones, tend to take about a year, and she just doesn't have a year.
Well, and I know that this podcast has a lot of listeners, and then they'll be working with promotion from like Blue Review and these things. So is there a guarantee that if you make an image that you'll get on the NFT? Because it seems like you could reach 1,000 pretty quick.
Yes. Yes. So by the way, I launched this a few days ago, and over the course of the first day, maybe like 10 people submitted. And I was thinking, oh God, I think I really overestimated people's desire to draw birds. And then all of a sudden the birds just started multiplying, and some of them
started flying in.
Yes. Marshall, it's the birds started flying in. So there's, as of this recording, there's 225 of them. I've discovered some really amazing artists, and actually just the fact that this many people are willing to take time out of their day to do this and to kind of pass on the message to other people is kind of amazing. And I almost feel very privileged to be part of the community of artists. And that was what I got the first time I ran the Birds for Sophia campaign, the initial one. I also didn't really believe that it would work, but part of the feeling that stayed with me, like part of the high when it worked, was also all of these artists getting together to make something happen. And that feeling is absolutely magical.
And this is the easiest way to save a life with your artwork. All you have to do, if you already have a digital image of a bird, just have to send it. It will literally take you less than 5 minutes.
So you don't send it. You make an Instagram post and you hashtag Birds for Sophia NFT. And you use either the message that I've sent on or there's instructions on the Birds for Sophia Instagram page and the link in bio. It is really easy. It'll take a few seconds. If this works, it's amazing. And even if it doesn't work, I still feel like it's a good thing worth trying. And I feel like if we don't try, we'll never know.
And I'm going to do one. And so for the people who do them, you'll probably get a little bit of, you know, possibly get some Instagram exposure or something like that, right? It'll sort of
The Blue Review is sponsoring the campaign, so they're going to feature some of the submissions on their Instagram page, which is gigantic. And I was talking to the editor there, and they were actually talking about an article both about the movement and about some of their favorite bird art.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, it sounds very exciting, and I'm sure you'll get a lot of people signing up on that line. If I'm the 1,001 entry, I'll still get in, or is it capped?
I think you'll still get in. If you're late, doesn't mean that you should procrastinate painting this bird. It can be the 1,001 artist NFT because Marshall Jones submitted his bird late.
That'll be my bird will wear 1,001 number on it.
Tung, you're going to submit a bird too, right? So 1,000 just felt like it was critical mass. By the time 1,000 people do it, I feel like other things start to happen. Press starts being attracted to it. If there's enough press, then maybe the right person will see it. The person who really wants to save a baby in Russia who's a few pounds under the critical weight for getting this kind of life-saving medication and happens to have $1.5 million that they would have maybe spent on an NFT anyway.
Does this have to be a drawing, a painting, or can it be a photograph?
So most of the people who've been submitting have been submitting drawings and paintings, some paper sculptures. But actually, I think if photographs came in, I would be totally delighted because there's so many really good bird photographers.
Exactly. Yeah.
So basically, as long as it's a bird, it counts. It can be an outline of a bird in the sand. Someone just submitted some embroidery, which I thought was pretty cool.
All right, guys. So get out there and get painting. Save a life. Paint some birds.
Guys, thank you so much. If you do it quickly because I'm generally a massive procrastinator. But in this particular case, time is of the essence. Like if this happens quickly, there's a much higher chance of this child being okay. I mean, this is kind of a horrible thing to say, but if we can't do it for this child, there's 38 children in Russia right now who need the same medication and who have to do the same $2.1 million fundraiser, but they have a little bit more time. So I think the reason that the fund picked this child is because she is critical on time. So let's try to make it happen for her.
Thank you, Dina. Thanks, Tana.
Thank you, Marco.
Thanks.
Go paint some birds.
Hey guys, welcome to Art Grind Podcast. I'm here with the amazing artist, Miriam Escafet, and Dina Brodsky as co-host. And before, we were chatting a little bit about Miriam painting the queen during lockdown, which is actually interesting that that was your project during that. I have a technical question to start with about the queen portrait, then we'll sort of go through your life. I noticed in a series of shots you had done, there was a completed background, like the carpet and everything, and then sort of empty legs. What's the reason for getting that completed in a section before going into?
It's how I tend to work. I tend to need to block the background in around my subject. To me it makes total sense because I think because that's the context, that's kind of the world in which your subject exists in the painting. And I could just block it in a lot looser, but because I'm kind of quite compulsive, so every area of the painting that I work on, I tend to almost just get sucked into that and want to take it to some kind of nth degree. And I knew that the carpet, specifically the carpet, was the first thing I started with because it kind of created the sense of space in the painting, which is always a very important thing for me in all my works. I really like to, I studied 3D design at art school, and I think my brain works very spatially, actually. So for me, paintings always have a spatial dimension, and I always have to key that in before. So, you know, if I were painting just, let's say, a head and shoulders portrait, then I would just probably just block in a background that was going from paler grey to dark grey or whatever, and I'd feel able to just get onto the subject straight away. But because the portrait of the queen had quite a complicated composition around her. I just felt that I needed to get to block those elements in before moving on to her, because, and also because just to get the lighting, to get some sense of the orchestration of light around her before arriving at her, which I...
Do you like the way it looks with just like that exquisitely rendered carpet with so much space and then just emptiness? Is that a phase that you kind of look at?
Well, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, there are certain stages in my work, and I'm sure that all artists have this, where you kind of know where you're going. You have an end image in mind that, I mean, it's never going to be 100% that, and I think you always have to allow for a bit of a shift as you develop the work. But there's always stages in the work that you think, oh, gosh, that's kind of interesting. I quite like it. Actually, that's not what I need to be doing with this work, and it needs to go somewhere else. But actually, this is quite interesting in a sort of slightly, almost like you have this element of hyperrealism, and then you have this element of abstraction on the same plane. And I think that can sometimes be interesting. So you kind of file these things away. You might never come back to them, of course, because the filing cupboard gets pretty full of stuff that you think you're going to come back to, and then some ideas you can come back to and others you can't. But and I always like, I really like the construction that I like I love the whole process of painting, but the thing that actually, if I'm honest, most excites me is when I'm working out the compositions of paintings. And again, I think that's to do with the kind of structure, spatial, it's almost like when I'm designing the painting, if that makes sense. And also the whole kind of construction of the painting, I really enjoy that, because there's a real intelligence behind that, that kind of...
Wait, Miriam. So Marshall jumps straight into the portrait of the queen. And Marshall, that actually counts as one of your three questions, by the
way. It was on my mind.
Could we actually go back a little bit earlier? Because I think you come from a family of painters. I found your father's work around the same time I found yours, and I was completely blown away. I mean, I remember finding your work on Instagram and then showing it to my parents and my sister and and calling a friend and being like, gotta check this out. So what was your childhood like? Kind of, were you just meant to be a painter
looking back on it, I guess I was, I'm not sure if I was meant to be a painter, but I think I was sort of, I think there was no escape from me. I think it was, I was actually born in Spain, in Barcelona. So I'm Spanish by origin. And my father's from there. And my mother's from London. So she sort of, and my mother went to art school in London in the 50s. She went to St. Martin's. And then in the early 60s, she went off to Spain, eventually met my father. They fell in love, got married, had three kids. I'm the middle one. And then when I was 12, they sort of decided, oh, wouldn't it be great to just, as artists do, they just get these ideas of sort of reinventing their lives. And they thought we'd move back to England as a family, which was actually, I didn't enjoy that very much, because I was very, very, I mean, I just remember my childhood with such happiness in Spain. And I was a very, and I still think the Mediterranean is still very much, I know I sound very English when I speak, but actually in my core, I'm very much a kind of Mediterranean person. So whenever I go back to anywhere in the Mediterranean, I just feel instantly like my soul just, woof, it just kind of opens up. I just feel, oh my God, I'm home. And obviously, particularly in Spain, but it could be Italy, it could be Greece. There's just something about the geography and the people that are all very similar around the Mediterranean, and just the kind of hyper kind of communication and expression, and the love of food and all of that, just kind of, I completely love it. So I found the move to England quite difficult, and there's an English way of being which is actually all about being kind of very quiet and very minding your kind of space, and that took me a long, long time to get used to, that kind of different, different psychology, really, of the nation, of the people. But then I also think, well, maybe if we hadn't moved to England, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now. You just never know, what life has in store for you, how your life unfolds the way it does. But yeah, my father was, he wasn't working as a painter when we lived in Spain. He worked as a sort of graphic designer for one of the biggest publicity agencies in Barcelona, which I guess at the time wasn't saying very much in global terms. But, you know, because he had three kids and a wife to support, and he felt he couldn't earn a living as an artist, and there weren't that many opportunities for artists in Spain. But he always had a studio at home, and he always worked at home kind of obsessively at the weekends. So I remember weekends for me, and I think probably this is why I became an artist, because I just remember weekends were spent in pyjamas with Bach in the background constantly playing, and my father just working away really quietly like a monk in his studio, and us as kids just being totally fascinated by it. And, you know, that thing of just tiptoeing around, you know, Papa's in the studio, don't disturb him, you know, that kind of thing. But you'd still tiptoe around and see what he was doing, which all looked and felt like magic, because he's completely self-taught, but he's incredibly skilled, you know, and he was always a brilliant draftsman.
You know, I was actually going to ask, like, where did he study? And I, because where was there back at that time to study the kind of art that he's making? Like, I can't think of a single...
There wasn't. I mean, I'm sure there was a good sort of art academy in Madrid or whatever, but he was a child of the Civil War in Spain, and he came from a very humble working class family. He actually had to leave school at 14 to start working as an accountant in a factory, and then just, you know, moved to, but he sort of was born in a sort of a town that was very near Barcelona, and as soon as he could, he moved to Barcelona. Because the very strange thing about my father is he says that he remembers that from the moment he was conscious, which I guess for most people is four or five, he absolutely knew with every fibre of his being that he had to be a painter. I mean, there was just no, which is a very unusual thing. I mean, it took me 20 years to work out what I was, you know, but I mean, he absolutely knew that he wanted to be a painter. And so that's always been his absolute goal, really. So he moved to Barcelona as soon as he could. And as I say, he started working as a sort of freelance graphic designer. And then after he got married and had children, he got this job at this publicity agency. So, but he's completely self-taught, but he always had this just incredible ability, which I actually think is a very Spanish thing. It's not uncommon in Spain to find people, I don't know if it's something in the DNA, but especially with the figurative arts, you know, you do sometimes find, you know, the farm boy that grew up in a village in the middle of nowhere that has barely even seen TV and can draw like Zurbarán or something. You think, where does that come from? You know, there's this kind of natural ability that they kind of sometimes have, and my father definitely had it. And then my mother had all her kind of kooky London art school kind of ways. and she was very creative, but she just became very creative around the house. And you know, we just, you know, we were always going off to see kind of ruined Romanic churches in the middle of nowhere. And if there was an art exhibition somewhere, we were always there to see it. And my father had the most amazing art books. And so I kind of grew up with all of that as part of my sort of hinterland, really. You know, that was the environment in which I grew up. And you take it for granted as a kid, but obviously that just goes very, very deep. And I really remember, honestly, I just remember, because my father had his art books all on a shelf that was almost at floor level. And I remember, I barely was even speaking at that age. I must have been two or something. My brother was a year older than me. And we'd sort of crawl around on the floor and just grab a big book by Bosch and sort of yank it out of the bookshelf and look at these extraordinary, surreal, frightening images, but, you know, from a child's point of view, they're just the most incredible things. And just feeling almost like just completely spine tingly, you know, just this sense that you were looking at this magical, amazing stuff that you didn't quite understand, but you knew there was something really deep there. And I think because I was just looking at this stuff from such an early age, I just absorbed it almost viscerally. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like I was introduced to this stuff at art school later and there was this kind of intellectual package that came around with it and this sort of historical explanation. It was just this very direct kind of visceral absorption of these images.
I actually get, like, you're describing that, your childhood, and I'm actually getting the kind of spine-tingly thing listening to you. And yeah. And I know that we all take our childhood for granted. And I know, you know, I grew up in like a really lovely family where there's just a lot of kind of love to go around, mm-hmm. and also a lot of books, you know, like that was pretty much when we came to America, we came with something like 30 suitcases and 28 of them were full of books and maybe the other two were, you know, were our clothes. But that, like, I'm imagining the sun and Barcelona and your father's yeah. and just being surrounded by paint and art books. And my childhood was nothing like that. And it feels almost like you're describing this charmed place.
I think it was. I think it really was. It just felt, it was a very harmonious house. And it was just very magical. And always at a slightly kind of higher frequency than normal, because we were just talking about art, or my parents were talking about art all the time, and just, you know, it was just, it was just quite extraordinary, really. Again, when I look back on it, you know, when you grow up in it, you think, and of course, you know, my parents had, they weren't massive, you know, they didn't socialize wildly, but all the friends that they had were either kind of photographers or, you know, so everybody was in that kind of world, you know, kind of quite rarefied, I guess. I guess that was there for me, you know. It was like it was given to me from birth, really, you know.
And so you guys moved to England, and then what happens?
So we moved to England, and, oh, God, this is quite a long story. So my parents wanted to find a really big home that they could. My parents had got really into the kind of macrobiotic diet. This was in the 70s. We were living in the 79. And I'm going to really summarize this because I could go on for hours.
And macrobiotic, when you just don't, basically when everything is just kind of bland, right?
And they wanted to find a really... So my father's idea was that they would open up a shop that would sell kind of macrobiotic produce, because he was almost like a religious convert to this. He thought the macrobiotic diet had changed his life, and he thought the shop would do so well that would allow him to just bury himself away in the studio and paint away without the need to. Because my father, he's just this weird combination of just incredible talent, but absolutely mortifyingly shy and just not wanting to deal with the world in any way, shape or form. My mum's the opposite. My mum's a kind of social extrovert. So she kind of complements that side of him. But I think his idea was that he was just going to shut himself away in a studio and just get lost in creating art. And of course that didn't work out because, you know, the place where they bought the house, which was near one of my mum's old art school friends, nobody was interested in macrobiotic food because this was 1979 in the countryside in England. So that was all a disaster. Anyway, they went through various years of trying this out and that out. And then suddenly my mother just put her foot down and said, look, we're going to... It was an amazing big house that they bought, but my God, it needed so much work doing to it. So the house itself turned into a massive project. And... So eventually my mother put her foot down and she said, look, we're going to just sell this house and just move to London and you're going to paint, which is what you were meant to do all your life, but not hide away from it anymore, you know. And they had brought with them from Spain, and again, this is something that I grew up with, they had collected since they met each other old church statuary that you could find in Spain that was really extraordinary. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They're called dalias in Spanish. They're those polychromed wooden carved Madonnas and saints, and obviously very Catholic, some of them with arrows, you know, bleeding sort of, you know, but and some of them were very, very old, some of them quite damaged, but because in the Civil War so many churches were bombed or ransacked, you could find this sort of stuff would come up in flea markets or sort of antique shops just randomly every now, because both my parents had such a good eye for spotting something that just was beautiful or had something very special about. They'd collected these sort of statues, which were beautiful, and they were hanging all over our apartment in Barcelona. So again, that was another thing that I grew up with, this sort of these very powerful sculptures, you know, that just felt like they were kind of, totemic, really, you know, just incredibly powerful things. And so they brought these, a bit like your family bringing 20 suitcases full of books. So we brought all these sort of church statues from Spain. You know, some of them were hundreds of years. You wouldn't be able to do that nowadays, I don't think. But and anyway, they sort of put them in auction and sold them because, you know, they were, which broke their hearts, really. And from that money that they got, they got practically nothing for it because, again, they were selling at the wrong time in the wrong place. But my mother said to my father, look, you know, I have this money in the bank now and I can feed a family of five on this money and you're just going to paint and we're going to see what happens. And that's when everything just turned around. That's when he, you know, started doing these very kind of simple watercolors, botanical kind of watercolors. And my mum just knocked on a kind of gallery door in London. And the woman who ran the gallery became really interested in this work. She obviously saw she had a market for it. And within 2 years, my father had his first exhibition in New York at the Kokar Gallery, which I think at the time was like one of the biggest galleries in New York. And it's closed soon after that. And then he went through a period of 10 years of having, I think it was 10 or 15 years of having exhibitions in New York. And his paintings just got, he moved from watercolors into gouaches. He painted in gouaches for about 3 or 4 years. And he did really extraordinary things with gouache, actually. And then he moved on to oil paints. So yeah, that's the story of, but for me, it's quite interesting because I think it's almost like he had to really crash to rock bottom before life kind of forced him into doing what he should have been doing, because in a sense he'd been sort of hiding from that all his life. He knew he had the talent, but he didn't quite have he didn't quite have the faith, actually, that his work would be wanted or would be sellable, or, you know, that he could make it as an artist, really, you know.
And what was that like for you? Like, as I, you know, did it make you feel like there's a potential future in this, or were you not thinking of, you know, having a life of art?
Well, yes, again, so I was, you know, going through all my schooling whilst all of this was happening, and I was very proud of the fact, you know, we'd all come out for the openings in New York whenever he had one of these exhibitions, and we were all in uptown galleries, all very fancy and swanky, and, you know, we spent 2 weeks in New York, which was fabulous. I absolutely love New York. And, but no, I think I learned various lessons. I mean, I learned how precarious being an artist can be, because the kind of financial story of my family is that it's been like ups and crashes and ups and downs, and there's no steady income. I mean, forget about that, you know. So there's been that lesson, but there's always been the lesson, which I think is the most powerful one, that which again comes from absolute childhood, that art. Well, according to my father, art is the most important thing you could spend your life doing. You know, in the pursuit of art is the most noble activity known to man, according to him. And I think there's part of me that sort of believes that. I'm maybe not quite as black and white about it. I think, you know, maybe saving people doing brain surgery is probably just as noble, if you know what I mean. But, you know, that thing that art really matters, and it's really important. And that actually you kind of, if you're serious about it, the life is going to test you, and you have to ride those deserts that are going to come your way. And I think they will come your way, even for successful artists. I know from the outside, it can all look very amazing and glamorous when you see that artists are having exhibitions in good galleries and whatever. But I'll bet you anything that behind the scenes, there are periods when everything goes completely quiet for them, or suddenly the market shifts elsewhere, or that just happens. That's just what happens.
Have you ever had a moment like that, a moment where you've considered quitting? Have you ever gone through that?
I've had moments when things have gone very quiet on me and very desperate. I've never weirdly considered quitting. And again, I think because I had the example that, okay, this is what it's like. And I know this is what happens, and you just have to ride through it, and you just have to dig deep and believe in what you do. And I think that, you know, without wanting to sound kind of mystical or religious about it, or I think that's what life does, isn't it? It kind of tests you in the places where you least want to be tested, you know, in the areas where you really just want everything to go fine. That's where life is really going to test you. And life is like that. Life is just black and white, up and down. And I think this modern idea that we have that everything's success is such a fallacy. I think if everything in your life went successfully, you'd learn nothing, really. And I think actually what you can do at those times when things really don't go your way, and you will experience a lot of anxiety, and you'll probably experience depression, and you know, it will be different for each person. The really creative thing is to turn that moment around for yourself. So weirdly, for me, after the economic crash of 2008, 2009, I had a big show in London. I think it opened on the day that Lehman Brothers went down. So in terms of timing, so that was exquisite.
It's like good luck, you know, it's like incredibly good luck that you had a show, but what terrible luck to have it open the day, you know, that
so nothing sold. And of course, it was just one of those moments where I just felt, you feel your stomach hit the floor, because you know what this is going to mean. You know what this is going to mean going forward, and you know what, you know. And then I had I just appeared where just everything, and I'm not alone. I mean, the whole art world just ground to a halt then, you know, and all. But weirdly, that's when I really turned to portraiture, because suddenly up until that point, I'd been working away, you know, with galleries, just doing kind of solo shows. And it would take me about 2 or 3 years to build up to having a solo show, because, you know, my work is incredibly detailed. It takes me forever to finish a painting. Which was fantastic. And I started to get solo shows very early on, which again felt normal at the time. But I realized, looking back, that was a very unusual thing to happen for an artist. And that was all fantastic. And I don't regret any of it. But it was a treadmill. Yeah, I was on this production treadmill to keep the gallery happy. Of course, I was keeping myself happy. But I mean, to fill gallery walls to produce a show is something that a certain kind of artist can do very easily. An artist like me, you're literally giving birth to quadruplets every time you put on an exit. I mean, it's what it feels like. You feel so, it's such a superhuman effort to do it. And I remember, you know, I was sort of in my 30s, you know, 40s then. And so I could do it. And I was working, I'd be working till about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and then getting up at 10 o'clock the next day, 7 days a week, 12 months of the year in the lead up to a show. And that was my life. And I was obsessed with just, I've got to get these 15 paintings done. I'm going to get them done come what may. And, you know, everything was sacrificed to this goal of getting these shows. And I think that actually, so when that suddenly after the economic crash, that all kind of ground to a halt. I say ground to a halt, sounds a bit dramatic, but everything really slowed down. And I suddenly thought, well, you know, after I went through my sort of night of the dark soul, as they say, and you think, my God, you know, I suddenly thought, well, actually, I've been really wanting to focus on portraiture for ages, but there hasn't been the time for that. And I've really been wanting to put my works into public exhibitions, of which there are many in London, you know, like the BP Portrait Award and the Royal Society of Portrait Painters. But I'd never explored showing my work that way. So my work had only ever been seen in private commercial galleries and bought by private clients. So it opened up this new avenue for me, which, you know, was hardly bringing any money, but I was able to explore kind of new ways of working. And I had the time in which to do it, which is really important. I mean, time, you really need to make time to explore new ideas, you know. And I think the downside of being kind of successful and busy is that you sacrifice that time, you know, because, so at the moment now, I'm sort of working on a lot of private commissions. And again, that's great. And I realize I'm very lucky to have that at this particular time when the whole art world has ground to a halt, that I have got private commissions on the go. But I'm craving kind of free time to explore, because I'm getting a lot of ideas for new, just slightly subtle different directions for the work. But I need to clear the decks to do that. You know, I need to have like a sort of clear horizon ahead of me, and I haven't got it. But you know, that's how it goes. You know, that's how it goes. So when things go quiet, that's a gift that you get, is actually that you do get that clear horizon. And it is an opportunity, actually, to try out new things, you know, that you might not have done before. And sometimes great stuff can come from that. Not always, but...
You know, it's funny how many of us, and I feel like we've talked about this before, Marshall, like that, you know, like, so I was in my 20s when, you know, during the crisis of 2008, and much like you, I started showing very early, and I had the cycle. I was doing these, you know, reasonably commercial kind of still lives that looked pretty over someone's couch, but, you know, I had a gallery or two, and they would show, you know, like, they would show the work, and once every year and a half I'd have a show, and that would kind of provide enough income to keep going for another, you know, like another year or so. And I kept doing kind of more of the same thing, which I was very proficient at doing. And then, you know, I think the last of those shows happened right before everything, you know, shut. And all of a sudden, I was working with a gallery in Boston and one in New York, and both of them shut down within like a few months, you know, like, and neither of them opened back up, I don't think. And all of a sudden, it was like having my carpet, my familiar carpet that I was always standing on, pulled out from under my feet. And I was like, well, now what? What am I going to do now? And the first thing I did was stop painting still lifes, actually. And I'm not sure my work got any better for a while after that, but you're right. It did give, you know, it's like, okay, well, if the gallery system isn't working, then what is? And if I'm, you know, if every place I've worked with that was selling my work is, you know, no longer there, then how do I support myself? And some of those ways were fun and some were not and some were tedious, but life forcing you to think out of the box hasn't been a bad thing. And I'm wondering if we're going to talk about this coronavirus time the same way. Like,
oh, I think we are, because we're in the middle of it, so we actually can't see what's coming. And I think the catastrophe is going to hit us this year, because without sounding doom and gloom about it, but I think a lot of people have been hanging on in there throughout 2020. But I think a lot of businesses are going to crash. I think a lot of galleries are inevitably going to have to close. I mean, I think the whole gallery system has been slightly up for question for the past sort of decade anyway. It's become a strange interface between galleries and then what goes on. You know, there's all these platforms like Instagram, which are fabulous for artists. So artists have become very, very good at getting themselves out there, making what they do visual to the world.
But it's because galleries have become, like, ever since 2008, at least, you know, I'm probably at like kind of a lower career, whatever. I'm not in the same place career-wise as you are. Like, I'm still learning. And so the galleries that I've worked with, at least, I mean, and a lot of them are great, but since 2008, they can't really support an artist. Like, even if you have a solo show, the things that galleries used to do for you, they just can't do anymore. Not because they're lazy or, you know, they're not trying, but... because you have to do it, like, and I think artists have had to learn it themselves because galleries have stopped being able to do it all for them.
It's all shifting, you know, and when you think back to the 60s, I mean, I wasn't even born then. I was born in 67, but, you know, that was the big sort of glory days of galleries, you know, the big kind of beasts like the Marlborough Gallery and, you know, the big names that came along and that was really the big era of the gallery where they actually made artists' careers. You know, they had all the power. They had, you know, nobody could contact or access artists other than through a gallery. The world has completely changed now. But again, everything's for better, for worse. You know, I never think that one thing is, you know, I think it's actually... I think it's good that artists have to get savvy and have to get themselves out there and have to... But then you also think, where's the control filter in all of that? You know, artists sometimes need curators, whether galleries can be that or not. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know. I feel like I feel like whatever version of the art world comes out of all this, it might be a better place for artists. Like, you know, like things are for better and for, like, I think it's going to be a worse place for galleries other than the ones that kind of figure out how to, you know, how to shift into whatever the, you know, beast wants them to shift to. But I think it might be a better place for artists, where artists have more control over their own career and more control over their relationships. And, like, I don't think the gatekeepers changing is a bad thing.
No, absolutely not. But, you know, it's also, there's always a kind of be careful what you wish for in life, isn't there? You know, because actually I hate marketing myself. I absolutely loathe it. I love Instagram because it's such a visual tool, and I love anything that's visual and it's got a design aspect to it, and you can, you know, you can really kind of design your posts and all of that. But I would love nothing better than some Svengali to come along and just say, you just create the work. I'm going to take care of everything else for you. I would just, I mean, like a sucker, I would just go for that within a nanosecond. Because I hate selling my work. I hate talking about money. I hate negotiating. I'm always underselling myself. Yeah, I'm just the worst person to be selling my own work.
Have you ever had that kind of relationship with a gallery, like someone who just took care of you?
I've worked with kind of big galleries. And I have to be careful what I say because I still work with galleries now on and off. And
We can edit out anything you want.
So galleries at the end of the day, and I know there are really good galleries out there, and they can do a lot for you, but in my experience, galleries are, they're just glorified shops, they're commercial enterprises. So inevitably, that's what they have to be. They sell your work. So if what you're doing works for them, you'll have a fairly good relationship with them. If what you want to do doesn't fit into what they feel they can sell, basically what they can commercial, you're a commercial product for them to market. And it's interesting for me when I have complete love-hate relationship with going to see contemporary exhibitions in galleries, because sometimes I just think I see art that I just frankly wouldn't even clean my bin with. It just being absolutely glorified and lauded by, you know, these big galleries. And the reason they do it is because it's art that can be produced like that. And it's a product. It's a product that they can sell at volume. It can be produced quickly. And it kind of looks, I don't know, painterly, sexy, whatever kind of cachet it fits into. And then I know artists that have so much talent that are getting absolutely no attention at all. And I know we can all have these conversations until the cows come home, you know. But that's how the art world functions. So that there's already, you're kind of, I don't know, you're stepping into Mordor, really, when you work with galleries. And you have, as long as you realise that and you feel that you can, you're kind of philosophical about it.
You can carry the ring,
as long as you're philosophical about it and you're getting something out of it, which is selling your work, which allows you to then carry on doing more work and also hopefully getting good buys for your work or whatever, and your name gets out there, then that's fine. But it's almost like two, I don't know, maybe actors talk like this about their agents. I don't know. It's like we all need the devil. We all need the devil working on our side. And I sometimes think the galleries are the devil working on our side. And that's awful because I'll probably meet some delightful gallery owner tomorrow. And I'll just think, God, I hope he hasn't heard what I've just said. But because they're not monsters. I know they're not monsters. But they have to do that grubby thing of selling. And selling is a grubby thing. And, you know, So they have to get their hands dirty. They have to do all that kind of really. I mean, they have to pay astronomical rents for their spaces, and they have to, you know.
I think it's actually really hard to make it as a gallery, and like in a lot of businesses where it's really hard to make it, the people that end up surviving are like, they're not the most pleasant. They're not. I don't know. I'm just looking for more Lord of the Rings analogies. they're not like Aragorn, yeah. You know, redoing whatever he did with the sword. It's more like maybe the ones that survive are more like Gollum, like scrappy and willing to do anything in order to keep
they
going.
Look better
and,
than
you
Gollum,
know, they're just like and being like precious. But you know what I mean? Like the people that survive in a hard business aren't necessarily like the most honorable people. And I'm saying that like the gal, like I work with two places in New York right now, and they're great, actually. They're great, and they're not like Gollum at all, or like or Sauron, or you know,
it's almost haven't been sucked out yet.
But I feel like like I've worked with enough people like that to kind of know what you're talking about.
What I'm really saying is that it's kind of, I think the selling, I mean, there are exceptions. There are artists that are fantastically good at commercializing themselves and selling their, and they do really well out of it. But I think as a general rule, it's not something, it takes a different personality type to the typical artist personality type. To market your own work is a really difficult thing to do. So in some senses, it kind of doesn't matter what galleries are. They could be the devil to you. They could be Gollum. They could be the Wizard of Oz, frankly. They could be anything. But they're the thing that you're not. They're the thing that you need to sell your work in some ways. And they can do, but I agree. I think there's a lot of galleries that don't really do that well now because they can't, because they're struggling. I mean, they're chugging along. They're, you know. Yeah.
Even the golems are having a hard time, but they can't, a lot of places, like, you remember when a gallery could, you know, they were supposed to get you, sell your work, and but also get you press and critics and, you know, maybe get you into museum shows. And I feel like the like that's getting rarer and rarer. But I feel like, and I don't know about you, but I feel like most of the press that I've gotten with my last few solo shows, it was just kind of, you know, like once I realized the gallery wasn't going to do it, I was like, well, I guess I have to do it myself. Yes. And I don't think
galleries are beginning to rely on artists doing it themselves now as well, which feels a little bit unfair because you kind of think, well, you know, that's surely your job, you know, that's what you should be doing. And that's what I mean. I feel like the boundaries are getting very blurred now, very blurred. Whereas before it was very clear whether you liked the gallery or not, whether you thought they were, you know, whatever. It was kind of quite clear what the gallery did and what the artist had to do. Whereas now it's all getting a little bit, you know.
But you know, I feel like 10 years ago it was clear why the gallery got 50%.
Yeah.
Now it's not, because, you know, they had the collectors and they had the connections. And now I feel like we, you know, like a lot of artists actually bring their connections to the gallery. So now you're right, it's getting blurrier. But I meant to ask, by the way, how did you, your paintings, I saw them in person for the first time at Sugarlift, which is one of the galleries I really like working with. And I kind of came up so close that I think the director told me to, like, you know, like not breathe on the painting. But they are so gorgeous in person. How did you learn how to paint like that? Was it your father?
Well, this is the weird thing. So I did go to art school, and actually I went to art school in the late 80s, early 90s. And I didn't know about places like the Florence Academy of Art, which I don't even know. I guess they were, so maybe it was embryonic at that stage. I don't know, but I didn't know of these rarefied kind of academy style schools, which I would have loved to have gone somewhere like that. I wouldn't have had the means to do it anyway. But so I had just took myself off and had a look at the sort of, you know, the big London art schools and other art schools around the country here. Because I wasn't sure whether I wanted to do sculpture or painting. I knew I wanted to do fine art. And I've always loved making. And I did it here. We sometimes do a foundation course. So it's a course where you just try everything out for a year before going on to art school. So it was during my foundation course that I thought, well, I'm not sure if I want to do sculptural painting. Anyway, I sort of trotted off to see various fine art sculpture and painting courses at the big art schools. And I just practically slit my wrists after going, you know, I swear to you, nobody was making anything. Nobody was drawing. Nobody was painting. Nobody was allowed to paint on a canvas. That was seen as sort of prehistoric, completely anachronistic. Everything was just conceptual, from one shade of conceptual to another. And so all I saw was students sitting in their kind of white little pods, their white little spaces, like pinning little concepts on the board, looking really depressed, not communicating, being almost kind of nonverbal. And I just thought, I think because I'd grown up with the example of my father doing all this amazing stuff, I just thought, what is this? This is just bullshit. And also, we knew it was bullshit because, you know, we were having these exhibitions around us all the time of just completely conceptual work. And I'm not saying all conceptual. I mean, it's not my bag at all, clearly. I'm not saying it's all a complete waste of space, but a lot of it is. And we have suffered a lot of crap in the art world in that sort of direction. But Anyway, I just came back to my tutors and I said, I just can't do 3 years of that because I'll never paint again, or I'll never make, if I do 3 years of that, I'll never want to do art at the end of that. I just knew it in my, it just with every fiber of my being. And one of my tutors said, well, why don't you do a 3D design course, something like that, which means you'll do something practical. You'll still get to go to art school. You'll have a good time. You know, we were all going to art school on grants on those days. So it was kind of like, yeah, whatever, you know, I'll just sort of float around for 3 days. And there were only two 3D design courses in the country. And one of them was in Brighton. So I went to Brighton and I studied 3D design. And still some of that weird kind of philosophy had seeped in even into the kind of 3D design course. So we did wood, metal, ceramics and plastics, and we made stuff. And that could be from very crafty sort of aesthetic to something kind of quite fine art. So it's a very broad kind of ethos to the course. And the ceramics department and the wood department were really good. And I specialized in ceramics. I actually loved working with clay. And but I very much knew that I was just doing that for whilst I was there, and that I didn't know what all of it was going to morph into. I would just find out when I left art school. And actually, when I left art school, I very quickly set up a ceramic studio with a friend, because I loved working with clay. And I had this ceramic studio, and I was making these very kind of big, ornate kind of urns and sort of slightly architectural pieces. My ceramics were very inspired by architectural design, really. And again, this is where the whole kind of making thing comes. I just really love constructing and making. And then I started to get kind of commissions for paintings, just weird things like painting somebody's kind of ancient gun collection in watercolor. So, you know, and it was just for money. I was just doing this stuff for money. In fact, that started even when I was at art school. And then I started to do more and more of that. And the ceramics was really difficult to sell. And then at one point I had a ceramic studio, and across the way I had a painting studio that I shared with somebody else. And then I suddenly started to get a little bit more interested in the painting and just exploring possibilities in painting. And I'd always liked, you know, painting is something that I always wanted to explore anyway. And I started with watercolors, and then I briefly flirted with acrylics, but I hated it. And it was when I moved on to oils that I suddenly, it was like a light bulb moment. I suddenly thought, oh my God, what you can do with this? This is just, you can get so deep with oils, and you can, it just felt endless to me what you could do with oil.
Oil paint is, so I just started oil painting for, you know, like pretty much the first time since March. And then before March, it was, you know, like I spent 2 years not doing it because I had a baby, was pregnant, all the stuff, right? And I was like, it's so much better than everything else.
I mean, each medium has its qualities and they're wonderful, but suddenly oil paints is like, I can't quite, it kind of has every quality that every other medium can offer you, but it's all there for you to explore. And it's kind of...
I feel like endless is like the best, like it's, it never gets boring because there's always something else that you can do with it.
It's kind of revelatory. It really is. And also the fact that you can, it's so fluid and it's so loose and it's just so flexible and it's so, in Spanish, we use the word plastic to describe, so we call them the plastic arts, which means that the kind of malleability of the medium, you know, the kind of expressiveness of the medium. That's how the word is used. And it's the most plastic of all the mediums, you know, it's just really incredible. And then, of course, I had the great luck of having my father my father's never taught me, but, you know, he said to me, when I first started working in oils, he was secretly very pleased because he was always hoping that I would go into oils because that's his thing. And after a while, he said to me, he saw what I was trying to do, and he said to me, you know, Miriam, he said, the way you're trying to paint, you really need to understand about glazing, and to understand about glazing, you really need to see the Dutch old masters. And he said, and in fact, everything that you can look at, just look at the Dutch still lives. He said, because technically, it's all there. And then they have to have a massive exhibition of Dutch still life painting at the Rijksmuseum, I mean, which I know is dripping in Dutch still life painting, but it's one of those blockbuster exhibitions they put on. I mean, I'm going back 20 years or so. And I actually went, my parents were going to see it. My father said, you need to come and see this with us. So, you know, I went with them. It was a lovely trip. And I just remember just being, and in fact, we bought this special, my father and I, we bought this special kind of monocle zoom kind of telescopic, you know, thing, because these Dutch still life paintings, they're like looking at you're just looking at the macrocosm of life. I mean, just the amount of detail in them is quite extraordinary. But of course, that was, they're beautiful paintings anyway, and the detail is exquisite and the technique is fabulous. But what I came away with was what they were doing spatially with the glazes, that sense of atmosphere. They describe, you know, there's Dutch still lives where you have, you know, three silver objects and they're quite Spartan, and there's a very directional light coming in. And it's almost like you can feel the light and the atmosphere has been painted on that canvas. It's a really extraordinary thing to be able to do. And it's very, you feel it. It's almost like you can breathe that air that's coming off that painting. And you can only do that with glazing. I mean, I know you can create atmosphere in all sorts of ways in oil painting. I'm not saying glazing is the only way you can paint, but that for me was the lesson. And I thought, I want to do this. I want to know how to do this. If they can do it, I can do it. You know, that's always been my sort of, and that really just kind of propelled the way I was painting in a sort of different direction. And then I started to, I was doing kind of slightly kind of surreal still lives myself. So it kind of fitted in with what I was painting. I just went through a period, I almost call it my monastic period, where I just informed, and thank God it was before the days of internet, actually. I'm sure the internet existed in some rarefied places, but I think the first time I sent an email was in 2001 or something, you know. I mean, I was just a very late developer with, you know. So it was in the days when you still had to go and look at proper books to see images. You still had to get to exhibitions to see work. I mean, don't get me wrong, I think the internet is amazing, but I think we're almost over-reliant on it now. We almost kind of image bulimic. There's so much out there for us to see that it gets to a point where it becomes almost meaningless, you know, whereas I think there's something about discovering something and finding something in a way that doesn't overload your brain, which the internet can do, that's really quite profound. And so I went through, I think, about 10 years of that, which coincided with when I was having these exhibitions, where, you know, I was finding verified books on, I don't know, Greek philosophy and kind of Greek philosophical ideas of beauty and what beauty meant, you know, in classical times, and which was actually a very profound idea. And architecture has always been a kind of obsession of mine, and sort of, I just have the weirdest books around that I bought. I don't buy books anymore because, like everybody else, I just Google something. When I'm interested in something, I just Google it. And I realize how tragic and pathetic I'm being by just Googling away There were amazing bookshops in the past. That's another thing that's dying out because of the internet. But it was like, it was 10 years of self-teaching myself how to paint just by painting. But more importantly, I think ideas, because I think the two things very much go hand in hand. So you can have the best technique in the world, but you've got to do something with that, right? You've got to say something, ideally. I mean,
how do you think the Greek idea of beauty affects your work?
Well, so I think because we had been, so, you know, going back to what I was saying earlier, when I went to art school, and beauty, like anything that was classical, you know, had become a dirty word. The idea that you wanted to paint or create something that was beautiful, it's almost like you had to stand in the public square and have rotten tomatoes thrown at you and explain yourself for having this crazy, primitive idea that beauty mattered, you know. And it matters, but finding the way to justify, you think, yes, this is exactly what I've been thinking. I just haven't had the words for it. So, you know, in classical, I'm sure you know this, but in classical times, the beauty was the physical manifestation of a heavenly order, of a heavenly idea of perfection. You know, so the idea of proportion, perfect proportion, which in modern times can seem almost fascistic, you know, the kind of, you know, that the human figure has to be beautiful. And, you know, now we're sort of, philosophically we think in a different way. But in its day, it was a very profound and noble idea, actually, that it was representing some kind of cosmic ideal of what the human being was and what the human being represented in interaction with the physical world. And so, you know, the idea of temple proportions and all of that sacred geometry all flowed from that. And it was just kind of revelatory to me because I just thought, yeah, this actually justifies what I want to do. It gives me a kind of way in to what I want to explore. And I think sometimes that's all you need. You just need that door to open and a chink of light to come through. You don't need to understand it all, but you just need, it's like an attraction, isn't it? You just need that attraction and then you just follow it and it just can take you interesting places.
I don't know if you guys have noticed this, or maybe I'm just living in some sort of bubble, you know, my little quarantine bubble. Where, remember when we used to have this conversation all the time, just trying to justify making something just because it was beautiful and feeling like that was enough. And I feel like I haven't had to have that conversation in a long time. Like I haven't had to defend what I was doing for a long time. And I wonder if the art world is, I mean, either.
No.
Either
I think that's
bubble,
changed,
which might be
thank God. And I think.
Like the art world is becoming more pluralistic and maybe more open to different, because I feel like that kind of, that the 80s, 90s conceptualism was so visually bland, that maybe even
it's
so,
like,
maybe.
we were in the gulag and we were just desperate to see some vegetation, I really was. It was depressing. It was depressing to be a student then, because especially if you were a student like me, of which there were many, by the way, who craved to express something other. And you saw that was the world in which you'd have to throw yourself out there and sort of justify yourself in the gulag that was what was surrounded us. Mm. It was just actually a very depressing prospect.
I went to art school at the tail end of that, and the art school I went to, the teachers were all the ones that grew up on that, and I remember this guy whose class I dropped out of after a day. His name was James Hendricks, and if you called him Jimmy, he had a total meltdown. And I mean, he was also about 7 feet tall and I don't know, weighed 300 pounds of just sheer muscle. But his claim to fame was that he was responsible for the world's longest brushstroke, which he dragged across the town commons. And, it was like whatever, a quarter of a mile, and shortly followed by, I'm assuming, the world's biggest expenditure of paint remover. But he would basically flip out if you tried to make something beautiful in that class. Like, he thought that painting other than in the way that, he would also like dip girls and paint, naked girls in paint when he was younger and drag them around a canvas. And that was okay. But making it like representational painting drove him to have like fits of rage. Yeah. And I feel like now we can just all do it without being afraid of, a seven foot tall guy threatening to throw it out the window or whatever.
No, and there was a lot of that. And it was also very male-dominated as well. I mean, the art world was very male-dominated. I mean, I knew there were big female names, but it felt like a very macho arena to throw. You know, there were these big male beasts of the art world that seemed to just kind of, and that actually felt intimidating. I mean, I'm not somebody who's easily intimidated, but it felt like I just don't fit into this. You know, I really don't. And then in the 90s, there started to be these galleries that started to show figurative painters, thank the Lord. And that's the galleries that I sort of worked with. And now it's just far more common. And I think people are desperate to see paint and lushness and something physical and visceral. And figurativism can give them that. It doesn't have to be figurativism. It could be a lushly painting, abstract painting or whatever. But
I think something beautiful and something that can make you feel something. And a lot of that conceptual art that you're talking about, it doesn't make you feel anything. Like maybe analytical and intellectually curious, but it doesn't I dare someone to come forth and be like, oh yeah, that made me really feel deeply.
And the other thing I think that art does, and again, this is just a very loaded word, but I think art makes you feel something spiritually. And I think that connects to the beauty aspect of it. I think beauty, the channel that takes you to feel something spiritual when you look at, and that will be a different experience for all of us. We'll all react to different works. But you know, that thing when you're standing in a museum looking at, you know, so for me it would be the Virgin on the Rocks by Leonardo da Vinci, National Gallery. I mean, I can't ever go in there and not go and almost pay homage to that painting. And for me, that painting is just so spiritually charged. It just takes me to another world. It just takes me to another dimension. Mm. And again, that's something that's very difficult to talk about because we kind of don't use that kind of language to describe, you know, we're kind of very caught in the kind of cerebral, you know, expression of the world around us. And and there's a lot of kind of, and I don't mean it in a religiously loaded word at all. I mean, I literally mean that.
Just something that takes you out of yourself, yeah. I think, or maybe something that makes the borders between exactly. this world and anything out there seem thinner or yeah. and more permeable.
Yeah. And the effect of that is that it makes you feel connected. It makes you feel connected to a different possibility, to the physical reality of where you're standing right there. Because we're very, day-to-day life, we're very grounded. We need to be grounded to get to the front door and open the door and go shopping, right? It's essential we're grounded. We're in the physical world. But we're also actually spiritual beings. We're kind of connected up there somehow. And I think that's what we do as artists. I think a lot of the time we're just bringing the two things together. And I think that when you have that experience that you're kind of slightly transported out of that physical space, for me, it's a really healing moment because it's like, yeah, it's not just about, you know, doing the shopping and paying your taxes or, you know, there's something just so unfathomably bigger than us out there. And for me, art is the way that I can connect to that. And again, in a way that I can't even explain or describe. And I get that when I'm working, interestingly, I get, you know, not every moment in the studio is a transcendental moment. As we know, a lot of moments in the studio are the kind of sweaty armpit moments when you're preparing the panel and you're kind of, you know, or you're just, you know, filling in that bit of the painting or whatever. But, you know, the moments when you're really tuning in to what you're doing, for me, I just feel like, I just feel like I'm suddenly connected to just a whole cosmos of ideas out there. And that all I have to do is just pluck them. It kind of feels like a gift from the universe, if that doesn't sound too mystical. But and it just, that's when I'm absolutely happiest. That's when I feel most secure, because I feel completely connected. I just feel connected to everything out there. And yet I'm standing completely on my own in my studio. I'm about as isolated as a human being can be. I'm like a monk at that stage. Yeah, I'm a monk saying his prayers, basically, but I'm just an artist doing my work. But it's just, it's a really, and I guess that's what people refer to when they say they're in the flow or whatever, you know, there's all sorts of language to describe this. But I actually think that's why art is so powerful, not just for artists, obviously, because we're kind of dealing with this all day long. But for people that view art, because I think that they sort of feel that. They might not feel it as powerfully. They might just feel the aura of that or whatever it is. And they might not even understand it, but I think they do experience a moment of transcendence. If they connect with the work of art, I think that's what it does for you. It actually transports you out of your kind of everyday sense of who you are and what life is about. And that's really profound.
No, it's a subject that's so fascinating to me, what you're brushing on. Because I'm like a sort of a reluctant sort of agnostic, you know, but art is so powerful to me. And I always wonder what that is. And I wonder if it's like an interaction with the unknown, like looking at, like you said, Leonardo's Virgin of the Rocks. It's like, there's so many mysteries that I'm brushing up against that I can't help but think there's mysteries and it's not all quantifiable. And then it's sort of, it leads me to these thoughts that I love having those thoughts. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. And actually there's nowhere better than being in the unknown. Really, that's kind of like, that's when you're an explorer, isn't it? And as an artist, you kind of, yeah, you want to be on sure ground most of the time. You want to know that you can do it, but you also want to be transgressing into that unknown territory. That's what makes it exciting, because that's when you'll discover something that you didn't do yesterday or the day before or whatever. I think that's essential to be slightly, you're not always going to be slightly on that edge. You know, there'll be times when you'll be doing work that, I don't know, you've been commissioned to do, and you feel that you're kind of doing something that you're very familiar with and you're, you know, you've done before or whatever. But when the good moments come along, I think there's always that sense of exploration, which is really important. And I think that, because it just engages all of your intelligence. And again, what is intelligence? Discuss. I mean, it's a huge, but I think that creativity uses every aspect of our brain and our emotional cells. I think that's why it's for me, it's kind of the most intelligent way of being to be. And by the way, you can be a scientist and be super, you know, at the high end of kind of scientific exploration. And that's incredibly creative. I'm not saying it's just a gift for artists, creativity, but it's kind of very clear that it can happen in art and how it happens in art. And yeah,
it's scary too, though, because like I think it's a Joseph Campbell kind of statement that haunts me, that's like, how do you know that you're on the right path, essentially? And I guess it's a boat metaphor or something. He says, because the shoreline keeps getting further and further away. So it's just like, that is exciting on some level, but also quite scary. there'll be more questions coming up than you're answering on the right path.
Yeah. But I think, absolutely. And we all crave security, don't we? We all crave to know that we're on solid ground. It's a very profound human fit. It's a survival thing, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I think, I mean, the fact that you've chosen to be an artist, it means that your survival instinct is probably not quite as fixed as other people's anyway, because frankly, you'd be doing something else.
That compass is just spinning around in circles.
Exactly. The tripod's already wobbly. The survival tripod's already kind of lifting off.
Well, that leads me to a question about one other one that I had written down about your directions in art, because I feel like there's that surge in a very specific section of your imagery. There's something that does feel a little more concerned with those more spiritual matters. Mm. And the, I don't know if you would call them this or if it's the term you would use, but more like the magical realism paintings.
Yeah.
Would you say that's a fair term?
I don't know. I mean, a lot of people have described what I do as magical realism. I prefer it to hyperrealism.
Hyperrealism.
I mean, okay. I think all these terms have their limitations, because ultimately what we do is a very organic lump of dough of all sorts of things in it, you know. But yeah, I think magical realism is probably not a bad way to describe what I do. So I
don't know, because I honestly, I don't think of them that way. Because I like so much, because I feel like magical realism is in a way kind of cheesier than what you do. Like yours are closer to, like when I saw both your work and your father's work, I feel like it's closer to those Northern Renaissance, like you're trying to speak to something kind of like, they're so intense, mm-hmm. and the surface is so kind of, you know, there's so much just time and life put into it that it feels like you're trying to talk to, mm-hmm. you know, the other side, what like by whatever objects you're painting, mm-hmm. or people you're painting.
Well, that's a really, I might just record that and write it down on my CV, Dina. That's the nicest description anyone's ever said about my work. It's lovely to hear that, because it obviously means you see that in the work, which is fantastic. But yeah, that's what I'm trying to do, really. It's kind of the I just bring so many ideas into each painting. And I think time's another interesting concept with art. You know, there's I've had to write quite a bit about my work sort of recently, and I have a sort of slight love-hate relationship with that, because, you know, there's that thing that if you have to describe it, then, you know, picture speaks a thousand words and you should, but actually it is interesting also to verbalize what you do and to verbalize ideas behind what you do. And I think I think sometimes art can sort of encapsulate the time that has been spent on it, and that's somehow caught in the finished work. And that's almost like an extra dimension in the work, which is quite interesting. Again, that begins to sound a little bit mystical, but you know, I think, and also, and the opposite is true, but art that's produced very quickly has a kind of vitality trapped in it, that it also, it has a different energy, which can also be really exciting. But I think art that's produced over many layers and over weeks or months or whatever, you can sort of sense, it's almost like that time pulsates out of the artwork. So it has a kind of almost other kind of organic essence to it. And you experience it in a different way. It's quite fascinating. You know, because when people talk about the difference between painting and photography, which I know is just such an old, but you know, people keep bringing it up. And I think, well, there's just an ocean of difference between the two things. I know that they can be reference points for each other. And I use photography in my work a lot. And I know photographers use painting as referencing their work a lot. And you get a really interesting kind of crossover stuff that can happen between the two mediums. But there's, and I guess maybe it goes back to sort of growing up with those kind of religious objects around me, that I just think there is also the power of the object. You know, when you stand, there's a real difference between looking at an image on a screen and looking at a work on a wall, the actual work. And I think it does kind of emanate a kind of, I mean, first of all, just the visual qualities of the paint, you can never reproduce. I mean, as good as an image can be, and now we do have staggeringly good images of artworks, and we can zoom in and almost see the molecular structure of the paint. But you always lose that kind of real-time visual quality of the work that you experience when you're standing in front of it. But I also think there's a kind of energy that emanates from art, you know. So I think it's important to experience art in the physical world, you know. I mean, it's great that we can all access images all the time, but I sometimes worry that we're morphing into a kind of, you know, a species or the next generation of artists that are only ever going to be looking at images online of other artworks. And what does that do to the art?
No, we're not. I mean, right. Like, it's still not, people are still going to want to see art in real life. And if anything, the ability to, you know, like I hate screens. Like, I hate what they've done to our attention span, but the ability to see art whenever you like has been one of the gifts of kind of screen time.
Well, I think if people talk about it the way Miriam just did, then they'll want to go see it. Because I agree with you. The screens are like, your glazing technique in that way, that's so steeped in history, but you look at it and you see layers, like you said, of time. You're seeing through time in that, and you're seeing a thought that you had on Tuesday, and then you're seeing a thought that you had, you know, 4 months ago at the same time. It's all just sort of in the mix, and it's like you know, looking through amber. It's like amazing. I love that. I think your technique supports your imagery so beautifully. But it's exciting to me.
What do you feel like when I think of your work, I actually don't, you know, and I realize that the Queen is sort of what, it got so much attention this year that it's going to be hard not to talk about it. Like, I feel like this podcast won't really be complete, you know, But actually, the first painting I saw of yours was, it wasn't even the portrait of your mother that won the BP Portrait Award. It was just a man's portrait, and he had curly hair, and it was such a beautiful, weird, idiosyncratic saying. And I was like, "Oh my, how is she doing that? Like, I can't believe, you know, I can't believe I didn't know her work earlier." But the portrait of your mother was the previous paintings that was just all over the place. And was that sort of, you know, like, and I think that's how a lot of people got to know you, you know. But did that change anything for your life or your work?
Yeah, tremendously. I mean, I know that the portrait of the Queen is a complete kind of one-off and an amazing thing, but I think actually I wouldn't have got the portrait of the Queen if I hadn't won the BP Portrait Award with the portrait of my mother. So that led on to me getting commissioned to paint the Queen. So it kind of all goes back to that portrait, really. It kind of, it just opened. So winning the BP Portrait Award, I mean, you know, I've been entering my work for the BP Portrait Award for years, and I know what a big thing it is, but I kind of hadn't quite realized quite what a big thing it is until I won it. And because I just suddenly thought, it's like everybody around the world knows about the BP Portrait Award, which I hadn't quite, in my own stupid little bubble, hadn't quite sort of twigged. But I think also the fact that it was such a popular portrait to win it, you know, and sort of the image went everywhere, and I got a lot of kind of press attention for that. And as I say, it was barely a year later that the head of the Foreign Office at the time went into the National Portrait Gallery to ask their advice. He wanted to commission a portrait of the Queen for a new reception room that they were designing at the Foreign Office. And he wanted to ask their advice as to who they might recommend, because obviously it's a, you know, it's a proper prestigious commission, so he wanted to get it right. And I'd won the prize the previous year. And so this was early 2019 that he went in there. And I think they've got together maybe six or seven artists that they kind of thought were good candidates, and they sort of presented him with images of their works. And of course, it was the image of the portrait of my mum, which he remembered seeing the previous year. And I know this because the woman at the National Portrait Gallery who he had the meeting with told me, and she said, and as soon as he saw that image, he said, no, it has to be her. He said, I remember that portrait. And he said it was completely stunning, and you know. And so anyway, the delightful thing is that as soon as I sort of came out of the meeting with him, I sort of was able to phone my mom and say to her, it's because of you that I'm now going to paint the Queen. So that portrait of my mother is just, it's like the gift that keeps on giving, you know. But in a way, I just think that's so lovely, because I think I just put so much love into that portrait. It's probably the most, I know it's the most personal portrait that I've painted. I painted a portrait of my father as well quite a few years ago. But with the portrait of my mother, I really thought, because when I painted it, she was already, I mean, she's 87 now, she's about to be 88, so she would have been 84, you know, when I started work on that portrait, you know, thereabouts. And, you know, when your parents get into their 80s, you're very aware of mortality. You know you're not going to have them around forever. Yeah, you know that time is precious with them, you know. And so that sense of actually mortality is very much in the sense of time. I don't mean mortality in a morbid way, but that sense of time is very wrapped into that portrait. And it's something that I really wanted to bring into the work. And that's where the moving objects came in, because I wanted to suggest time moving around my mother. And I wanted her, it's very much a portrait of her, but it's a very archetypal image. I mean, it's kind of slightly Last Supper-ish, if you think about it. There's a lot of kind of Renaissance archetypal kind of composition in the image. And, you know, the vanishing point comes to her. You know, so the objects are very carefully choreographed, so they suggest this sense of perspective, kind of, you know, all meeting here. And then I thought, really, I actually want to kind of convey a sense of the universal idea of what the mother means to all of us. I mean, I know some people have horrendous relationships with their mothers. Not everybody has but you know, but we're lucky. You know, the mother is actually probably the core emotional relationship of our lives. She's the person that gives birth to us, and she's the person that's there for us our entire, you know, it's the most profound, I think, emotional relationship from which all other emotional relationships sort of grow. So I just wanted to sort of just get a sense of that in the portrait. And I thought, well, and I wanted to make it quite poetic. So I thought, well, she's kind of like the still point around which everything turns, which is where the idea of time came in, and having that movement in the objects. And also the title has a sort of almost treble meaning, you know, an angel at my table. So the literal idea of that title is she's the angel at my table of life, you know. And you know, really some of my nicest moments are breakfast times with my mum, you know, because she can literally just talk till the cows come home. And, you know, she's, the kitchen table is the place where she will sit there and she will not move for hours, and she will just talk away. And it's that, amazing sense of organic time that you sometimes experience when you go back and spend time with your parents. You know, it's like growing up time goes away and you're still in kind of pajama land, and you can just be chatting for hours and it doesn't matter. And all of that really lovely kind of maternal energy, you know. But there's also the kind of angel, it's actually the Nike figure, which I'm slightly obsessed with, but it's become a sort of angel figure in the painting. So I purposely put that in because I thought that it just makes you question the title, because an angel at my table, that could be the angel at her table, and it's actually moving. And then there's also, there could just be like an angelic presence around her, you know. But it was just amazing for me to get that kind of people. And so many people just wrote to me and said that they could see their mother in the portrait. And yet the portrait could not look more like my mother. I mean, it is absolutely my mother. And yet everybody could see aspects of their mother in the portrait, which for me was just the nicest validation, because that is absolutely what I tried to get a sense of that in the portrait, but I didn't realize it was going to be so literal for people that they would be able to really read that.
You know, it does look just like your mother. Yes. Because you have a photo somewhere with your mother next to it, but it's also so much more than just, like to me, it almost doesn't feel like a portrait even. Like, it's so much more than just a portrait or just a painting. And it doesn't look anything like my mother, like the, but it's, I don't know. I remember the first time I saw that, and I remember like looking at the hands in that painting and just being, that is one of the most beautiful bits of painting I've seen in, I don't even know how long. it's so carefully sought, it's sought out. Like, I feel like there's not an inch of that painting that doesn't have your thought in it. And it's not like you pre-planned it all. Like, you might have done that all. But no part of it feels incidental, I guess, or accidental. Like all of it comes together into this thing that, yeah, I am doing a really terrible job of expressing that. Sorry.
No, you're hitting the nail out, because it wasn't all planned out, but you're right. It's like, it's a painting where everything, I realized at a certain point when I was painting it, that everything came together. Everything in that painting had a meaning, and it all kind of, it all fitted like a jigsaw puzzle. And just, that was like, ooh.
Everything feels purposeful. Hmm. Like every decision that you made feels like it was a conscious decision. That was what I meant to say.
Yes.
Not all this garbled stuff as I was trying to, you know, let clear.
Maybe it's not horrible. Don't worry.
but Miriam, if I understand you right, you sort of found that while you were painting, like, did it come together kind of halfway through or towards the end, or was it
I started off, I did a drawing of her before the painting, which turned into a very evolved pastel study. And mainly because I just started to get into working with pastels at the time. So I wanted to have an excuse to work with pastels again, because I love them as a medium and I love drawing. And I love, again, it's about creating that little area of thought space. You allow yourself a bit of thought space before you kind of throw yourself into the painting. That works for me anyway. So it's about extending the process. And I love the process anyway. So I like, the longer I can make the process at arriving at the canvas, the better for me. Because that's just where I have fun. That's just where it all comes together for me. So anyway,
hang on 1 second. Everyone who's taking classes with me, listen to that. Let's fly back.
Because it's kind of, it gives you that time to really understand what you're doing. Because quite often you don't understand what you're doing. You might be doing it really well, but I think if you can bring a bit of consciousness into what you're doing, you can then turn it into something actually quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And you can own it more, you know. Mm-hmm. So I did this drawing, which turned into this very bold pastel study. And I knew, the first idea was just to have my mother at the kitchen table, because as I say, that's where we spend, when I see her, that's where we spend most of the time. And, you know, she's always drinking tea. And so, you know, and I love still life and I love composition and I love working out perspective. So all the objects were there to satisfy all these reasons. And it was when I finished the pastel, and if you see the pastel study, you'll see the composition is what, she's almost identical in the pastel study to the oil painting, but the objects have moved around a bit from one to the other. And it was when I finished the pastoral study that I realized that actually the objects were really important and that the objects conveyed a lot of meaning. And that for me became like a thrilling little thought. You know, sometimes you have thrilling little thoughts that just, you know, they're very ordinary thoughts, but they have. So I thought actually the objects carry meaning. I like that because again, I do think that objects can carry meaning, but you have to, you're the alchemist that has to give them that meaning, right? As an artist, you're that's what we do. We sort of create alchemy sometimes. So that's when I started to really think, what are the objects doing here? And that's when the whole kind of idea of the movement came in, which, and I hadn't quite resolved which objects were going to move in the painting. So that evolved as the painting evolved. And I shifted the composition of the objects just because the weight of them looked better, you know, one way rather than the other. And I liked putting the teapot at the very forefront because it makes it enormous and yet somehow it works. And, you know, so as Dina said, a lot of thought and a lot of, so there was actually, trying to remember the time frame between the pastoral study and finishing the painting was almost like 18 months because I did the pastoral and then I got busy with other projects and then I returned to do the painting. And again, that was probably valuable because it just allowed me to digest the idea. I think sometimes we can be in too much of a rush to get stuff done. And I think to just let things digest. I think creativity is a very organic, I think it all happens in a very organic time frame. You can't rush it. You can't, you know, and you really have to give yourself time to understand your own ideas actually and understand actually even why you want to do something, you know, why you want to, you know, why you might want to paint this subject matter or, you know, so that's something that I'm doing more and more with my work. And of course, the flip side of that is that I was already a slow painter because my paintings are so meticulous. So I've just actually made my painting process even slower because I now do all these kind of layout drawings before I start a portrait, but I love doing them because I just, it's kind of like, God, how would I describe them? It's kind of the gestation period. You know, it's kind of where I'm just sort of playing around with different possibilities before committing to what the painting's going to be.
You know what? So what I wanted to know about is what's your life like right now? I mean, it takes us forever to get these things edited. By the time it's released, you know, there'll be, you know, you might be vaccinated, the lockdown will be over. But right now, London has one of the harshest lockdowns in the world at the moment. You know, you can leave the house for, you know, one walk a day and to go grocery shopping. You have your commissions, but what is your life like both externally and internally?
So my life, my studio's at home anyway, so I have an apartment here in London and I have the biggest room is sort of been turned into my studio. So in a material sense, there hasn't been a big shift in my way of working because, you know, and I've always worked very strange hours, you know, I'm a very nocturnal worker. So I'm always slightly in my own different space-time continuum when I work and I've been like that all my life. So I'm very used to being slightly out of sync with the rest of the world anyway. But what I do and what I love to do, I love to pop up for air quite often. So I like to go and see exhibitions. I like to even just go and sit in a cafe and watch the world go by. I love to go to bookshops. I love to see friends. I love to go out for meals. Of course, all of that has just not happened for a year, like for all of us. I think that's a very typically kind of artist way of being. I'm very self-sufficient, so I can spend a lot of time on my own and it doesn't bother me because actually I think in normal life, if we ever get back to that, but in normal life, what most artists crave is time on their own because life crashes into that too much often in normal life. So well, in a sense, what the pandemic has given us for some people is way too much time on their own. But I think for artists, it can be a gift if you use that time properly. But at the same time, there is this weird sense of just everything not being right in the world. So what I was saying earlier about you're kind of completely on your own in your studio and yet you're sort of hyper-connected to the world. So my sense of hyper-connectivity feels a bit weird because I realized that the world is just in a very weird place at the moment. So there is this sort of undertone of unsettledness because of, you know, and, you know, I have elderly parents that I kind of worry about, and, you know, but yeah, in terms of my work, I'm just, and I it just so happens I was busy finishing the Queen's Portrait when we were in deepest lockdown, and I've got, you know, a few commissions on the go, which even happened as a consequence of winning the BP Portrait Award anyway. So I've got enough work to be getting on with, and I realise that's a very lucky position to be in. And I'm not sure how it would have been for me if I didn't have that, because in a sense I have to get this work done, so I don't question it, I just get up and do it. If I was feeling a bit like I'm floating around and finding projects to be kind of self-creating for myself, I don't know how efficient I would have been at it, because I know some artists have not found it easy. They haven't found it a productive time, even though on paper you'd think, well, hey, you've got all this time and no distractions and you can, you know. I know that some artists have really struggled with kind of focusing at all. You know, it's been a very disturbing time for a lot of people, but for me, it kind of hasn't. It's been a good time to focus on work. But yeah. I don't know if that answered your question or not.
what's the first thing you'll do once the lockdown is over?
Oh, gosh. I'll definitely go to see exhibitions. I'll definitely go, as I said, I'll just go and sit in as many cafes as I can find. I'll go in as many bookshops as I can find. I'll go and see friends. I'll go... I'm not somebody who's out every night by any means at all. But that sense of being connected with the world, you know, it's just, I just deeply, and I'm very much a city person. I was born in Barcelona and I've lived in London, it's one of the things that the city gives you is that sense of hyper-connectivity, isn't it? Which I actually really love. I love that about city. I love getting on the underground. I mean, of course, now that feels like the craziest thing you could do is to get on the underground, and I don't know if it will ever feel safe again, actually, but, you know, I love that whole thing of just being amongst other people, you know, it kind of feeds me.
It's the last time I was in New York, it was, you know, and I knew it was going to be, like, it was mid-November, I kind of knew that it was the last time for a while, and I had a bunch of business stuff to do, and I had it all scheduled, like, you know, the business meetings and seeing friends, and, you know, usually, like ever since the pandemic started, whenever I'd go there, I'd take a bike, and I'd bike from place to place, and the last day, I just took the metro everywhere, and I was like, it's just one day, and like I know what you mean. I love it. Like, I love taking the metro, and even, you know, even with everyone wearing masks, just I love being around strangers. Yeah. And I kind of realized that, you know, A, it sounds crazy, and B, probably not even necessary back then. It was just my goodbye to New York was that way.
Yeah. No, I completely understand that. Yeah, it's that sense of being connected and yet in an anonymous way that you can be in a. It's a very particular thing, and I really love it, you know, because you become an observer in a city, don't you? I mean, it's I think it's a gift for an artist being in a city, because you're so close, and yet you're always an observer, you know. It's kind of, there's so much happening around you.
You're kind of anonymous enough that while also being kind of like, if you want to have humans around at any point, you can. And that's part of what's been so tough. Like, people don't really want to talk to each other right now. People don't want to talk to strangers. They're more like, you know, like get away from me, you know, or, you know, keep 6 feet distance and a mask and, you know, maybe try to make it 10 feet. Like when I think of things being, you know, the apocalypse being over, just being in a crowded coffee shop, and
I know it's bliss. Absolutely, that's probably the first thing I will do. It sounds really shallow, but you know, it's really what I miss.
Miriam, I have a question on behalf of some of the classes that I teach, because this question gets asked to me a lot, and it refers to more of your. Your more seemingly conceptual works. And the question's always a little bit clumsy, but like, they are so layered with imagery and inspiration, and there's an idea there, and it's not always totally clear to the viewer. There's room for the viewer to speculate. What are you trying to get at with the more composed paintings? Like, is there an underlying sort of worldview or philosophy? What helps you guide you in the imagery you choose?
Yeah, are you referring to the kind of more like fantastical still lives, that kind of?
Yes, yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yes. What was I trying to do? I think I was exploring a lot of ideas for myself, and I was doing it in quite a playful way. I was also doing that thing that I was talking about a little bit earlier, imbuing objects with meaning. So I think what can happen in still lives is that just the interplay between the objects just gives an added dimension to them, and also because in a lot of my still lives, because I was using objects to signify other things, and I was sort of half constructing objects or half deconstructing and blending different objects with each other. And so I was bringing that whole kind of making side of me that has always wanted to be part of what I do. And I always find a way of constructing things and little props that then become objects in my paintings. And that somehow just, again, it feels a little bit like creating magic. And again, that's another, you know, what does that mean? But, you know, that thing of you're kind of, you're turning an apple into a pear. You know, you're kind of doing something, and in the process of doing that thing, you've kind of transformed that entity into something else. And that feels exciting. And then painting that, and then always leaving, hopefully always leaving that window or that door open so that the viewer can just step in and they can read some of that, but they can't quite understand it all. I mean, I like paintings that for me trigger a lot of questions or that have a sense of mystery to them. I'm very drawn to that from painting, because then it's kind of, I get quite obsessed, you know, I just think, my God, what is going on here? And you just kind of, you're going to have to keep coming back and looking at it and observing it because you're wanting to understand it. But you're also wanting to get lost in the not understanding it, because that's also a nice space to be in, I think, as the viewer. And in fact, I have a friend who's a writer who I have really interesting conversations with about creativity. She's one of the few people I can really talk to about these ideas. And she was one, we were talking about one of my works, actually, one of my portraits. And you know, she was saying, you know, very nice things about what I do with the sense of space in the painting and whatever. And she said, yes, she said, it's sometimes when you're standing in front of these paintings and they have this kind of incredible, and she's a trained architect who's become an author. And she said, you get this sense of spatial quality in the work. And she said, I call it the space of longing. And I thought, gosh, that's such a fantastic way. Wow. I wrote it down. I've got it pinned up exactly. Write that down.
I'm writing it down right now.
Nice Carolyn Steele.
Marshall, write it down, and maybe could we call the interview?
Yeah. I just thought it was such a fantastic, because that's exactly what, because she said it's a space that your imagination wants to enter, you can't physically enter into, and yet your whole imagination is wanting to enter into that space and explore it. Mm. And it's kind of, it's almost like a melancholic feeling. And I think we all, it's just amazing when you find somebody that can put into words things that you experience that just are so nonverbal when you're experiencing them, you know. And so I thought, yeah, it's kind of, you know, and I'm not sure if I was achieving that in my paintings or not, but I think that's what I was exploring. I was exploring that kind of tension. And also with still lives, it's about the space between the objects as much as the objects themselves. So it's a whole... It's such a lesson in kind of painting and composition and understanding actually what kind of pictorial art or drawing or the pictorial language does and what the figurative language does. Because I think with figurativism, especially now, there's so much emphasis on the human figure, and I totally get that, because it's so, I mean, there's nothing, when I'm drawing from the model, I'm just on a different galaxy. I mean, it is the most zen thing you could possibly do with you're absolutely lost in that very sacred moment, which to me feels like a very sacred moment, because it's so ephemeral, because the model might move, the model will need a break, you know, the session's it's always a tenth of the length that you want the session to be, you know, it just feels so precious, the whole thing. And you're so absolutely in that moment, and it's just absolutely magical. And obviously we're human beings, so we relate to other human beings intensely when we see a depiction of a human being. But I always say to, and I have done a bit of teaching, I mean, I'm not doing any teaching now, but I always say to students, actually, you learn almost more from still lives in terms of the basics of form and space and kind of the nuts and bolts, really, of, you know, describing form and space than you do from working straight from the figure. Because I think sometimes the fact that we're, the way we relate to the human figure is so emotional, you know, and that's amazing, but sometimes it can almost get in the way of understanding the formal things that you're doing with the kind of, you know. So I sometimes think it's probably good that I came to portraiture after spending many years painting the weird kind of still lives that I was painting, because I really learned everything then. And of course you're always learning, but I felt that I arrived at portraiture with a kind of like a toolkit under my arm, you know, and I felt I had confidence that I knew what, you know, I didn't think, oh gosh, how am I going to do that? And how's that going to work? And, you know, I felt really confident that I had the tools to do what I wanted to describe in portraiture. I've forgotten what the original question, I'm just sort of rambled on to some.
You answered it, believe me. It was okay. Really perfect.
Sorry.
So, by the way, Miriam, I mean, you say you really like bookstores. What are you reading these days? Or what kind of thing do you like to read? I feel like you're someone who might read a lot of books.
I actually haven't read for such a long time because I've slipped into a really nocturnal working pattern, which is my natural way of being. I think that's my Spanish DNA. We're just nocturnal creatures, and we just like get very mentally active at night. So, you know, a lot of nights I go to bed at 3 o'clock, or, you know, and so the last thing I'm going to do is kind of pick up a book and read when I get to bed, because, you know, my brain's just on the point of shutting down by then. But what was the last thing I read that really impacted me? I read a while ago, but it was the last of the kind of serious big books that I read, which was Milton's Paradise Lost, which is a bit heavy, you know. It's simply because I've been...
But also totally amazing.
Oh, I mean, I was going to go on to say...
Paradise Lost is one of the most beautiful things ever
completely
written.
I was absolutely transported, even though you're reading it in Old English, and I'd heard so many people saying how it was just the most beautiful poem written in the English language and whatever. And I thought, well, I just have to read this. I bought myself a tiny little penguin version of it, which I still have because I've just scribbled so much stuff down the side of every... I mean, and the thing that really struck me about it is it's the most visual thing I have ever read. I mean, the visual descriptions in that book are just so fantastical. When you think that Milton was blind, you just think... I mean, the power of his imagination is extraordinary. It's completely beautiful. So it's really moving. The devil is this tragic figure in the story. And it just amazes me that nobody's actually tried to make a film of it, because, you know, with the kind of CGI abilities that there are nowadays and whatever, I just think it would just make them... I mean, it's probably just as well that they haven't, because it stays the pure thing that it is. So no one's going to corrupt it. But,
you know, they never did that. But a guy named Philip Pullman, who lives in Oxford, wrote kind of like a children's or young adult retelling of Paradise Lost that I haven't like reread Paradise. Like Paradise Lost for me was a one-time thing. Like I did it, and right now I'm not sure I have the mental capacity to do it again. But I reread his Dark Materials, which is Philip Pullman's kind of trilogy based on Paradise Lost, probably once a year. And they just did an HBO kind of...
No, it's magical.
Dorky stuff. It's really good.
It's really good. And I love Philip Pullman too. And I think that trilogy is fantastic because it's so... He's borrowed, but so cleverly. I mean, heavily from Paradise Lost, but also Greek mythology and all sorts of, you know... And he's just such an ideas person. You can feel that when you read his books. They're just fantastic.
He's actually just started publishing kind of like continuations of that trilogy but written, I don't know, 20 years later, and they're totally terrible. So if
I'll leave it so you start material soon.
It's one of those things where I never thought that I would hate Lyra, the main character from His Dark Materials. But like, apparently both her as a baby and her as an adult, which is where those later books go, are incredibly annoying. But, not to ruin it for you. That was totally a tangent. But do you have any kind of advice for advice either for artists who are just starting to make work now, or maybe advice that you could have given yourself, I don't know, 20 years ago, like when you were just...
I think it's always probably dangerous to give advice, but I can certainly tell you things that I've discovered along the way. So the most valuable lesson for me, which has proved right every single time, is that whenever I've embarked on a piece of work where I've thought, this is really going out on a limb a bit, this is way too ambitious, by the time I finish this work, it's going to be so expensive, no one's ever going to buy it, it's just crazy, why am I doing this, but I just kind of have to do it, and I'm going to do it anyway. That's the work that everybody responds to. That's the work that somehow, and it's always the work that somehow moves me in a slightly different direction, always for the better. So I always think, be as ambitious as you can be and as you want to be. I don't mean in an egomaniacal way. I mean, actually in a humble way, but be ambitious with your ideas and never try to keep it safe, because there'll be a million and one other people trying to keep what they do safe, and you're just going to fall into that kind of pool. And if you have the ability to do something extraordinary, then just go out there and do it, because you owe it to yourself, and you know, you owe it to everybody else in a way. So that's because, you know, being an artist can feel very scary and it can feel very precarious, especially when you're starting it out. So the instinct to kind of keep what you do kind of saleable, relatable, even whatever the bag of safety stuff is for you, is going to be really strong. And actually, in my experience, it's when I've really gone out of that and thought, no, hell, you know, I really need to explore this. I just really need to get this out of my system and just do it. And that's the work that, it might not do it for you instantly, but that work will pay off. That work or works or whatever comes out of that will be important, actually. And the other thing that I always say to people is that, you know, the only reason for being an artist actually is to do absolutely what you want to do. And again, I don't mean that in a brattish way, like I'm going to smear poo all over a canvas. You know, I mean, like, you know, you owe it to yourself to absolutely express whatever it is that you want to express kind of with fullest passion. Because it's actually not about earning a living. We all need to earn a living. We all need money. That's just, you know, that's the currency of life. But that's not why we become artists. If you want to earn a living, there are a zillion and one easier ways of doing it than being an artist. So that's a problem you need to kind of take care of, and it needs to happen. But that must never be your kind of motivator for doing what you do. I know that sounds like a strange kind of contradiction. And also just, just immerse yourself as deep as you can with everything that inspires you. I mean, really, because that's what's going to feed you. That's really what's going to feed you. And surround yourself with the people that support you, that believe in what you do, which is going to ultimately be a very small niche of people. It's not going to be a huge crowd. It's going to be a very small niche, which will include family members, no doubt, and maybe just a couple of friends or people that you were at art school with that are like your, you know, buddies for life or whatever, but they're the kind of support group that are really going to pull you through and be there for you. I think whenever I'm feeling a little bit flat about, you know, what I'm doing or just life in general, I just always have to take myself off and see something that I know is just going to feed me, and then it just changes it all around for me. I kind of remember why it is that I do what I do and that I want to do what I do. And also sometimes you need to have a break You know, sometimes you just need to have that beach holiday, that mindless total beach holiday or whatever, you know, or sit in the cafe and watch the world go by, whatever does it for you. But just kind of be good about feeding yourself.
You know what I just realized, like right now, as you're talking, is that I think maybe what feeds me is this podcast. Mm-hmm. And like talking to you, and after like we just did this for 2 hours, and I'm like, oh my God, I want to paint. I'm going to pick up my kids and, you know, and make dinner. But having conversations with other people who are making like real art, like you're making real art. Like I think, you know, like, yeah. And there's artists that I admire where I'm like, oh, you know, like I like this thing that they did, but I don't like this thing that they, you know, this other thing that they did. Or I'm like, okay, like I can tell this person's really talented, but like they'll make something incredibly great in 5 years. With you, I feel like what you made, you know, like I feel like everything that you do is real art. I don't know if that, and even like hearing you talk about it makes me want to go and make something real, whether I'm capable of doing it or not.
No, I'm sure you are. I mean, absolutely. I've seen your work. It's fantastic. No, but I think it's also about honesty. And I think what we've had is a very honest conversation, and probably half of it will have to be edited out. I don't know. But I was saying earlier, it's very rare that you can't have this sort of conversation with just anybody. It's very rare to be able to have these conversations about what we do. And, you know, and I don't need to be having these conversations in order to do what I do. But when I do have them, they do feed you, because you just feel, you kind of feel recharged by it, you know. So this has been as lovely for me as it has been for you, because it is a very rare thing to be able to talk about these ideas that are so kind of ephemeral, you know, and they sound so fanciful, and they sound, and, you know, I'm sure to a lot of people they might sound like total bullshit. I don't know, but I know that you know what I'm trying to say, and I know what you're trying to say, and it's kind of communicating at that level that's really lovely.
Well, I have one question. Will you be my best friend? You have been absolutely amazing on this show. It's like, it's everything I'm interested in talking about. You talked about it so like profoundly, and actually, I mean, a lot of the questions I had have gotten answered. I wrote down a bunch, and just through the way you're talking about it, I was like crossing them off as I went. So I don't really have any just questions left. It's been great.
Actually, Miriam, to what Marshall said, when the world opens up again, I will take you for if you're ever in New York again, I'll
definitely be in touch. I'd love to meet in real life, in a real cafe, wherever, on the underground, on the tube.
I'll take you to my favorite coffee shop, and then we can ride the metro together, just up and down for no reason.
Hey, thank you for listening and coming along with us on this long journey. I hope you got some good takeaways from this interview. I want to let you know that we have an official Art Grind podcast hotline now. So call us and let us know what sort of creative projects you have going on during these crazy times. Let us know what's on your mind, and we'll play it on our next episode. The number is 929-267-4830. Again, it's 929-267-4830 at artgrindpodcast.com. And follow us on Instagram. And if you feel like supporting us financially, you can easily hit that donate button on our website. And if you feel so inclined, leave us a review on iTunes. That will really help us. We love all the support we get from our listeners and hope to do our best to bring you more great interviews for you. So be safe out there and stay on the grind.